I've had a request to talk about the will, as it is a very, very difficult subject matter, and a lot of people confuse an impulsive, reactive behaviour with a willed action. And this is a very difficult subject, so we'll have to take it very carefully to make quite sure that we do not get hold of the idea that anything that we do without consideration is an act of will. Without consideration, an impulsive act can occur because we have already inbuilt reactivity in our body from our ancestors. We have instinctive reactions which are not wills. They are reactions to external stimuli which have been fixated in the ancestral protoplasm, and they're still functional in us until we learn how to distinguish between a reaction to a stimulus from outside and an inner act of initiative will. The lady at the back there wants to sit down, I think. Well, she might get frozen like Lot's wife. Now, we'll have to define will very carefully, and we'll use the phonetic base for this purpose, and we will take the letter I as a dot. I will draw you a dot in case you see, we can't even draw a dot without assistance. And we're going to recur to this fact that the existential, finite, egoic, material being cannot actually do anything whatever without help. I will now put the dot approximately in the middle. There it is. Is that visible? Do I have to crane my neck around to see it? No, I believe you. You can see it? Would you like it bigger? No. Well, actually, that dot is a location which, to be quite accurate, should have, at Euclid's point, no dimension of a spatial order. It should not be measurable at all. Because if it's measurable, which this particular dot being made of ink is, if it's measurable, it's in the material world of inertia. But the thing that it represents is exactly the opposite of inertia, namely initiative. Now, initiative can locate itself anywhere, but it has not got a material, finite locus. So here we have a visible dot representing an invisible point of initiative. So that initiative point is a precipitate of the infinite field. The infinite field, prior to any dots whatever, is the cause of the appearance of the initiative. In the same way, in the symbology of the hand, the palm is the source of the outgrowth of the thumb. And the thumb represents the initiative. The thumb grows out of the palm and represents initiative growing out of that which is prior to initiative. The initiative is the point of beginning. Now, I'll have to despoil this diagram of the dot a little bit, because I want to explain that when it became what it is, a point of initiation, a point precipitated by infinity. Infinity represents sentient power, utterly unconditioned, but which by its own self-precipitation makes the first condition a formal existence. The first condition of form is a point. All bodies are made of points of power, points of energy, points of force. And complex gatherings together of such points constitute what we call bodies. Our own physical body is a highly complex occasion of a self-positing field, making points of function throughout itself. But the fundamental is one initiating point, the first self-precipitated point of infinity. And you know that it has been said that the victory over error, over sin, over guilt, over crime, the victory was won before the foundation of the world. That means to say, in the infinite sentient power field, the authority for everything that is going to happen is in that field. And when it posits a point, it does not lose control of that point. The field precipitates the point, and the point precipitated is the field there, self-positive. Now that word initiative we find in the simple expression initio, I begin, a Latin formula. I'm going to put the other letters there. That particular point there is the point that begins to say e, and then immediately negates itself. That's in. Now the letter N means continuity of motion. The point initiated starts a motion. The motion immediately following the point of initiation is an inertia. It is something that has arisen only because the initiating point posited itself. So the IN, the point motion there, is already a duality. That the motion symbolized by the N is negating the positive initiative of the point that started the motion. This is quite a tricky concept. Prior to initiation, there is an infinite sentient power field, which is called spirit, and it is called God as the effective cause of the universe, the manifestation. It is an infinite, that is, unlimited field of sentient power that has posited a point within it. It could have posited that point anywhere, whatever. It wouldn't matter where. But the first point posited is the point of divine initiation of the cosmic process of creation. So when we see IN, I'll put a little vertical under that dot now. That vertical is not really the letter I. Really, the dot is the letter I. I know a particular Greek grammar that says to contrary to this, and says, how foolish are non-Greek thinkers who put a dot on the I, and they then write our little vertical stroke and say, that is a Greek I, and the dot on it is unnecessary. Now, in fact, the reverse is the truth. The dot is first, and the line was put under it so that you could recognize where the dot is. Because on a piece of crude paper, manufactured primitively, there could be impurities in the paper, little dots, even little deposits of Mr. Bellamy's caterpillar dung might fall on the papyrus, and you might misread that as a dot and ruin the manuscript. So to make sure that you did not misinterpret, under each little dot there was placed a directive line pointing and saying, this is a dot. This is a D-O-T. This is a divisive zone of crucifixion. I'll draw the divisive zone of crucifixion there. There is the zone because it's circumscribed. There is the activity, the vertical. And there is the passivity, the horizontal. This is called the symbol of symbols, the supreme symbol because the circle denotes the zone of consideration, the vertical denotes the activity, the power, the effectual, which is there, and the passivity, the horizontal, denotes the fact that when power moves, it imposes on itself and is the sufferer of its own self-precipitation. That's already a very highly complex symbol. I want you to mentally transfer the super symbol of the cross in the circle into the dot with which you started. Condense it. If you like, you can have a little indicator pointing. All the symbolism is gone into that little dot. So when you see the dot, you must notice that the word dot has three letters in it, and it signifies a divided zone of crucifixion. So the dot is already not a simple unity, it is trine. It is a trinity. It is a power, it is divisive, it is zoning, and it is self-crucifying. It fixates its own self-power with its own self-precipitative act. And we, in fact, do this every day. When we think, we choose a thought and then act on the basis of that thought. We choose the thought, that is a form, we identify with it, and we then use it as a basis of action. And if the thought is incorrect, the action is going to fail. So when we look at this word, in signifies a dot, which is essentially movement. It is not a thing in itself, of itself. It is a motion of the infinite sentient power. So the simple little word, apparently simple word, in, is not so simple. Remember, the word simple means complex. Sim means seed, and the PLE at the end, play, means folded. So the word simple means seed, folded. Folded into the seed is a total tree. Folded into the acorn is the oak tree, mysteriously. The oak tree, invisible, is in the acorn. All it needs is a drink of water and some warmth from the sun, and it will become an oak tree. The oak tree is already there in the field, waiting to draw through its precipitated point, the acorn, drawing from the field of infinity and producing a visible tree through a very minute seed. Now, I am in, and that's going to be reflected in it. Now the it part there refers to the in, and the in as in it, the cross in the circle, symbology published in that point. So when we say in it, we are mentally grasping a point, and that point which we grasp is threefold. And necessarily, and for all beings, that includes us, we are beings. For all beings, every point of initiation, every idea we posit, every so-called will we set into operation, every emotive judgment we make, we impose on ourselves. Very often, greediness, which means leakage, tries to posit things beyond its own grasp and then sets in motion a negating process, the end, which will prove the impossibility of succeeding in that area. In it, a point posited by infinity negates infinity and thereby negates its own freedom, its own grace in the act of self-positing. And when we see the it part, in this apparently complex word, is really a series of words tied together and said rapidly. So, the it is another way of saying the in, but now stressing through the T the crucifixion. That letter T is this cross, taken out of its cosmic context and published by an active intellection of ours in the primordial point with which we started to do the diagram. Now, following this self-crucifixion, you'll observe that as egoic beings, that is, self-determinant or believed self-determinant beings, the tendency is, if you take up any position whatever, that's a point of view, a point of dish, a point of differential divisive issuance, that when you take up that point, if anybody comes along and contradicts you, your first thing is not to accept the contradiction, not to let go of what you have posited, but to affirm it. Now that's affirming of it is I zone. Now this Io is a short form of the word Jehovah. Io means God. When you say Io Pam, I am all nature, the God of nature. Pam, nature. All positive actual motion. Or P, positive actual motion. That's Pam. Very often translated as nature. Io, this is a great, apart from being Italian, for I, myself. Io Pam, exclamation mark. I am all there is. In the great panic rites, pre-Christian, the great shout of jubilation occurred in the initiations when a person was informed and could grasp truly, I am all there is. I see a lot of people, and I know that those people are in my consciousness. You look around, you see everybody else. Everyone you see is in your consciousness, of your consciousness. You are seeing your own content, apparently extrajected, thrown outwards from the center, the original point, and displayed around you, peripherally, as other contents of your consciousness. And then when you realize that, there was a great shout of jubilation in that great ritual pre-Christian amongst the Greeks. Io Pan, I am everything. If everybody in the world contradicted you, you would shout back to them, Io Pan, I am all things. You who shout against me are only myself self-projected to contradict me, to make me conscious that I am me. Where me means substantial life. The letter E, our letter E, can be found in Hebrew manuscripts a long time ago, written like this. That's simply the letter E. Amongst the other Hebrew letters, of which we have today 22 survivors, and amongst them is written this form for the letter E, and it means threefold life. I think, I feel, I will. And that think and feel and will has been posited in that point. Every point that we posit in our consciousness is threefold. It is a thought point, that means form. It is a felt point, sentient power, in aesthetic, that is feeling, self-evaluation. It is a will point, positing. It is a think, feel, will, trine. So you can imagine the great jubilation when they were engaged, funnily enough, particularly at Easter, when the sun rose and the moon coincided with it. That meant the will arose and the mind coincided with it. There was total congruence of will and intelligence together. And at that moment of self-realization, can you imagine thousands of people gathered together in a tremendous festival of Easter, that Easter, that Oyster, that point of arising of this awareness and a terrific cry of jubilation, Io Pan. Each one, each point saying, I am all. And knowing that all the other points are saying, I am all, you have the total justification of self and the total refutation of finite egotism in one cry. That's the Dionysian cry, which acts against empirical, intellectual, Apollonian restraint. Nietzsche made much of the Apollonian Dionysian opposition, where Apollo was used to represent civil order, and the Dionysian spirit represented the free energy that refuses to be dictated to. I saw on a newsreel yesterday a lot of policemen, about 1,000 of them, controlling some picketers, and there were mounted police there, and the strikers were actually, in power terms, outnumbered. Now the police, whether on foot or mounted, guarded, they represented the Apollonian spirit of civil order. The hungry, the underpaid, the ambitious, the instincts of the people who had not that power represented the Dionysian revolutionary spirit. Now both of these have to be in balance. If you kill one or the other totally, the world ceases. If you kill the order principle, there is no civilization. If you kill the Dionysian rebellious spirit, there is no energy to do the work. If the civil authorities gain total control, civilization would be reduced to a mere mechanism. If the revolutionary Dionysian spirit broke out of all control, there would be total chaos, which you have seen in the last year on various occasions in different cities, where ordinary citizens apparently for some reason go berserk, break all the shop windows, steal all the goods, smash the water pipes, ruin the possibilities of safe travel through roads, vandalism, violence increases. If all the world were deprived of order totally, there would be chaos. There would be the state prior to creation. Now creation starts with the point positive, the intent. And in it, your affirmation of the whole zone of that being. Here we have three words, in, it, you. It means the point is moving, the point has crucified itself, the point is all there is for that point. So that when you say initio, which means I begin, you have actually said, I have imposed on myself by my positing of an idea, a form of limitation, that this limitation will continue unless I contradict it, and that I am crucified by my identification with the form that I have posited. So if I say I'm one of the nine parties, say left, right, center, if I'm one of those and I read the pamphlets and obey them, I am imposed on by me, my life is finited, I become relatively unintelligent. You've seen the miners' union contradicting its own members, imposing rules. You've seen some miners insisting on the right of the individual to go to work without being ordered to go to work or ordered not to go to work. There's a contradiction within the contradiction. Now the purpose of affirming the individuating point is nothing but this, to demonstrate that finitude is no good. That finitude, that separativity, that non-relation cannot work. The universe of finitely identified beings is simply a demonstration of the impossibility of a functional world based entirely on separative atoms. You all remember Paul Getty in interview accepting the definition of the richest man in the world. You may remember he said he wasn't going to give anything to charity, and got all this money, and what some people call the pseudo-Rubens in his house, and the incapacity to know whether it was genuine or not. He had so focused himself on becoming the richest man in the world, he, by his own focus, had deprived himself of information about other sources. He imposed on him. Subsequently, he repented a little and gave some money to a children's charity. But he was then recognizing by force of circumstance created by him. Circumstance had proved to him that he was impotent at the very point where he had gained his total victory. Because, you know, he, the richest man in the world, never went out with a wallet in his pocket. Because he knew, as the richest man in the world, if he did, he was inviting muggers. So he used to go about, say, "My pockets are empty. You will gain nothing if you beat me up." So in being the richest man in the world, if you accept the definition, which I think personally is a piffle definition, and if you did accept it, you had to say, the richest is the poorest. The richest in potential is the poorest in actual. This is tremendously important. Initio, I begin. When I begin something. Now we have done a little diagram on other occasions to show the order. And we're not so far away from Easter, so we can talk about it again in relation to that, and in relation to crucifixion and baptism in the symbolism. Now we must remember this, Christianity is only Judaism disguised. Islam is Christianity and Judaism represented. Fundamentally there is only one religion. And that religion is always presented in the same way, but under different verbal expressions, and on the different geometrical symbols. Now we represent a man as a chest, a belly, and the head, and the little gap between. And we're going to mark it 1, 2, 3. And we're going to go like this. Now one represents the heart. Heart represents he art. He means life. Art is simply another form of the name Arthur, and also Arto Tura law. The heart has four chambers in it. And there we see our mysterious sign again, with the unity at the bottom, apparently making a duality at the top. And we have the cross in the heart, because the heart is the realm of feeling. And prior to creation, this feeling is infinitely extended throughout the whole cosmos and beyond. It's absolutely infinite, transcendent feeling. And the feeling is twofold. The feeling is a power, because it knows it is power, and the feeling is of compassion. Compassion means suffering with. And what it is suffering with is itself. There isn't anything whatever other than that infinite sentient power. Now to suffer is subfer, to be underneath what is done, facere, to make, to do, sub facere. Suffer. When we do something as a sentient power, we place ourselves under the effect of our own action. So we suffer. So in our symbol of the circle with the cross in it, which we now change into a heart shape, and we're now going to do the heart this shape. Three becomes one. That is the one. Think, feel, will create the individual. The way we think, the way we feel, the way we will informs, formulates us on the inside. And we then pay the price of our own self-definition. Now this feeling represents, prior to creation, the infinite sentient power field. And that is a unity of thinking and will, simultaneously co-present with itself. Now, if it were to remain in that, we must call it a condition, that is a withsaying of thinking and will. If it were to remain like that, in infinity, the world as we know it would not exist. We live in what is called a fallen world, a world fallen into finite identification. Now, in that feeling of perfect balance of the infinite sentient power, perfect balance of infinite sentient power, there is no need, there is no lack, there is no deficiency, there is no ground of movement. And yet, mysteriously, movement occurred. When the movement occurred, it occurred by grace. Now, grace means freedom. At some point, a movement occurred. And the movement, therefore, if we say the field is number one, the movement is number two, and the number two, written Roman style, means duality. The moment the movement occurs is very much like a current of water in the ocean. You all know there's a thing, a Gulf Stream flowing across the Atlantic, and it warms certain parts of the British Isles. Very mysteriously, within the ocean, which when you look at it, you wouldn't think it, the ocean is full of rivers, full of streams. It's all water. But the temperature at different places within that ocean is different. And consequently, the apparently uniform ocean is not uniform. It's full of tremendous streams driving along. And at some point, heat is added. We know that in the great depths of the ocean, at a certain point, there is a chasm, there is a cliff, there is a cleft in the ocean floor. And volcanic powers come up there and heat the water. And the water rises up there and then goes out, streams along. So that a river is inside the ocean. And exactly the same way, by heat, observe the word heart is only the word heat, with an R inserted, by heat, which means hierarchical intent to eat. Hierarchical intent to eat. Now when you eat, you take in power from your surroundings. You can do it by sunbeds if you like, or you can do it by cosmic radiation. Jesus calls that food you know not of. Or you can do it simply by eating your fellow physically, or eating his little business up into your big business. But this question is, the heart is the center from which arises the heat. And this heat appears, because it is sentient power, appears as an appetite and generates a primordial motion, and the motion makes a stream within the ocean. So I now represent London Underground. There it is. The circle is the ocean, and this straight horizontal is the stream within the ocean. A stream of moving power, which gives you evidence of a gradient, because that cannot move unless there is more power at one end than there is at the other. Now the center from which the power originates is hotter than the periphery. That's why the sun radiates millions of tons of photons to us every day. There is a great aggregation of power and then streaming out from that center to illimitable peripheries beyond. From the heart, therefore, a stream goes down. The heart is representing Eden. Eden has four rivers streaming out of it in the symbol. It enters the realm of duality, because then physical movement occurs, and like the movement of the streams in the ocean, those streams in the ocean can catch jellyfish and transport them this way rather than that way. It can cause plankton to coagulate in certain places. It can cause weed to pile up in the Sargasso area. That stream divides the individual life from the surrounding infinite life of the cosmic ocean. So that when we come down into the belly area, the bell needs to swell. It means energy has gone down, piled up, and now one's out. It goes out into experience. It goes out ordinarily into an aggressive act against the environment. It goes out to dictate terms on the surrounding environment. But the surrounding environment, which you represent with a square, a cube, a block, throws it back on itself. And that gross material world that we encounter when we hit ourselves, tap things, that gross world throws back on us information about the way we have struck at it. Now that gross material world is an absolute necessity for spiritual education. If we hadn't got the gross material world to throw back on us the effects of our own actions, we could not know what kind of beings we are. It would be quite impossible for us to have self-knowledge unless we encountered the resistance to our own self-activation. And when the reaction comes, it gives a shock to the initiating motion on the lower belly, and it bounces upwards and goes in the head. And in the head, it now has three. That is, it has an original feeling from which arose a motion of the will, which rushed out, struck an obstacle, the outer world, was thrown back by that obstacle, and rose, carrying a record with it of the initiating feeling, the divisive result of the motion, and the thinking or formulating process of that total self-created, self-precipitated, self-reaction generation being. So our thinking process then becomes on guard. And we're going to call this thinking process, which is the product of reaction, the empirical intellectual process. Empirical, derived from experience. Experience is what we have externally to ourselves. We have a reason derived from external reaction to the stimuli that we offer to reality. We throw things at reality. Reality throws them back at us, and from that there arises the force of reaction, which goes up into the head and becomes empirical intellection. We call the accumulation of the information in your head progressively the raising of Cain. Cain means intellect. Cain means canniness. Cain means knowingness. And it arises from collision. So we now have an empirical, intellectual process in our head as finite, materially informed beings, the source of our information being the external world. Now there is another kind of intellect. The kind that existed before the initial movement which created the division. And that one is called Logos. L-O-G-O-S. Logos signifies the absolute formal structure of infinite sentient power in its simultaneity totality. Now, when we are in the empirical intellect, we look at things and we decide. Would you like to put the cap on that for me? Do you know where the cap is?
Yeah.
Why are we putting it on?
Because you asked
it. Why do I want it on?
Possibly for some type of demonstration.
I want it on because it dries up if it's not capped. Now, it's on a simple little fact like that that human egotistic terror is based. The ego thinks if it doesn't keep its thinking cap on, it will dry up. It thinks that its life in itself will shrink. And it will become nothing. Isn't that true? That when you think about yourselves as finite, limited, conscious beings in a physical body, and you think, if I deprive myself of food, of emotional relationship, of thought, I will shrink. I will become less. Everybody tends to believe that. The exact opposite is the truth. But the empirical intellectual can only think that way because the content of the empirical intellect is externally derived. So its idea of form is the form that's been thrown back at it as a reaction to its own action and comes back to it in finite structures which it can grasp, because they are finite. Now, if they are finite, they are limited, they are circumscribed. If they are finite, they cannot apply to what is beyond their legitimate zone. Now, let's think about the word baptism a moment. Baptism is an immersion. And the external interpretation is an immersion in water as a symbolic gesture of an immersion in anti-water, that is spirit. Now we will use H for hierarchy of spirit, and we will use M for water. The Hebrew letter Mem symbolizes water as plastic substance, but mass inertia with a degree of viscosity. And viscosity is a degree of inertia, and that is the absence of initiative. Now the H means hierarchy of powers, aware that in any substantial sphere, that is a mem, a letter M, in any substantial sphere, nearness to the center is nearness to power, whereas peripheralization is loss of power. If you get a mass of hot water, then you were to blow yourself a globe in outer space of water, and that globe is there, and you then shine through it with laser beams at right angles to each other, and you heat the center where the rays intersect. Now the center will radiate the heat to the periphery, and the periphery will radiate it to the environment. So it will be hottest at center, and that means more energized, and towards the periphery it will be cooler, less energized, and at the most peripheralized it will believe itself indifferent. It will reach a kind of equilibrium between its own temperature and that of the environment. Now when you are peripheralized in that way, you believe yourself powerless. You have abandoned your center of initiative, and you believe that you need something from outside you to give you the energy to initiate an act. Now, as long as you believe that you need a stimulus from outside to generate the power to make a new act, you are in a state of subjection to that belief. Now, there are two baptisms. Brahmins wear a twice-twisted cord to symbolize that. In Christianity, we talk about a birth from the mother, just as you are born from your mother, from water, and another birth from spirit. Now, the glyph of spirit in the Hebrew is shin, which means fire. So if you then put shin, fire, there, and water below it, and then read it shamayim, that way, that means heaven. That means a balance of power, which is infinite, and water, which is substance, recipient of that infinite, according to its capacity. Now, it's an absolute basis of hierarchy in all religious teachings, that there is no hierarchy other than this: the capacity of the individual to receive the enlightenment. Nothing limits the person, except that person's own incapacity to accept the enlightenment. Now, the incapacity to accept enlightenment is the exact degree of egotism. The more you believe yourself finite, the more you believe yourself self-willed in opposition with all other wills, the more you believe you have to fight against other people to survive, to get justice, the more you believe that, the more you darken your own consciousness. Darkened with counsel, it's called in the Bible. You tell yourself things, and the more egotistic you are, and the more you tell yourself from an egotistic base, the darker becomes consciousness, the less you understand. The greater and the lengthier the explanation of the ego, the less enlightenment in it. Now, just as there is a baptism from spirit into matter, there is a counter-baptism from matter to spirit. Now, you remember, we started with the heart as the center of an infinite field of power. We then move downwards into the appetital centers of the belly, start a motion which is divisive and moving towards egotistic attempt to impose on reality, and then the reaction. Reality throws this attempt back, and it bounces up into the head and becomes empirical intellect. Now, empirical intellect is filled with forms derived from external experience and not from anywhere else. A mind like the British empiricist, illustrated perfectly. A man who believes in nothing except information from his five sense organs, or their extensions, telescopes, microscopes. From the external world, information is gathered, it is stored in the memory, and then the information is compared in the mind, and then a conclusion is drawn. But all the information has come from the external, and the external is the weak. The external is peripheralized. The external is not the energy center. The external has no power. The reason that the external can stimulate you is not because the external has power, but because you project interest. The power is your interest, which you project into the external world. Now, when you enter from free spirit, free grace, free intelligence, into identification with the material body and the materially centered egoic structure, that's called the baptism from water, or the baptism from your mother. Nicodemus says, what? To be reborn, have I got to go back into my mother's womb? And Jesus says, oh, come off it. You're a wise man in Israel, you must know these things. You have to be reborn to the awareness that you are not a finite egoic being. You have identified with one, but you are not one. The finite egotistic being tries to gain power, tries to retain power as an ego, tries to impose power on other egoic structures. And it's fundamentally in error. So you have to be reborn. Now the empirical intellect, being furnished only from externals, cannot believe in anything other than externals. What a horrible condition. You refer to your mind stored with empirically derived external objective forms, and you ask that mind what is possible. But what you've put into it is all you've got to deal with. You posit a certain kind of universe according to your will to interpret, and then you store it in your memory, and you're stupid enough to ask that stored memory what is truth. And there's nothing in that memory except your erroneous interpretation of reality as finitely formed, structured and structurable and controllable from the egoic level. What a pathetic position. You project what you want to be, you disregard what is, namely infinity, you disregard spirit, and you construct for yourself a safe world out of your collision with the empirical physical world, not recognizing the empirical physical world is a precipitate of an intention of the will. And then you think, I must consult my intellect, which is my bright spark. That's called illumination. Now the word illumination is from lumo, a light. Lumo means smoky light. Got an M in it. It means obscured light. There's another one, L-U-X, lux. That doesn't mean smoky light. That means clear light. That means pure intelligence. So to be one of the Illuminati is to be an intellectual, but not to be enlightened. It is to be smokily lit, not to be clearly lit. Now the Illuminati say, we are the rulers of the world. We have studied the law, we have learned all the forms of experience, we have structured the world according to our will, we have set up a hierarchy of importances according to our will, and we now say there is none other than that which we have set up. And to solve the problem, we will refer to our inner records of what is in fact nothing but the library that we have written ourselves. The books in our library are our own writings projected. We project the books, we write the books, and then we sit up all night and study the book we've written. And we're looking for what? Enlightenment. We don't get it. What we get is illumination. Illuminated manuscripts. Actually, the picture's in a very good medieval illuminated manuscript are more interesting than the text. If anybody knows, it's examined those in the British Museum or elsewhere. The illustrations are marvellous and full of symbols, but the written words do not explain the symbols. So you can find a number 8 woven into a picture of a man. And it's quite obvious that the scribe that painted that, or the monk who painted it, has either thought of it himself or been told by a superior. I think that would be improved if you put the number 8 in the corner. And the 8 means the 8th letter. And the 8th letter is Het, and Het means hidden hierarchy. And in another place you'll find the 4, which is half an 8, which is a reference to the fallen world. There is more information in the illuminations, the pictures, than there is in the text. Now, what are the conditions of the rebirth into spirit? The birth, number one, birth into matter from spirit is easy. You fall. You simply move finitely, focus on what the finite movement teaches you, make records of what you learn from your finite movement, declare it authoritative because it is experiential, and become wise in your own conceit. Conceit means concept. you then think that because you have had experiences, you are now wise. You're not. Wisdom doesn't mean knowledge. Knowledge is serially gained, sequentially gained, one by one. Wisdom is the totality of the structure of the Logos field itself. The infinite sentient power is called wisdom. When the lines taken out of it like the streams in the ocean are not called wisdom, they're called knowledge. Now, no amount of linear knowledge can add up to cosmic wisdom. So, in order to escape the impotence of egoic identification with one's own self-willed pattern of behavior, one has to give up the empirical intellect. Now, from the point of view of the egotistically identified consciousness, identified with that finite, that intellectual empirical, from the point of view of that egoic structure, to give up the intellect is to die. It actually feels like a death. All the things I have worked for, all the things I've striven for, all the things I believe are essential to my triumph over other people in the world are rubbish. I have to let go of them, I give them up. It is experienced as a death. And all the great mystics in all the great religions say, it is a death. It's a spiritual death. The ego itself is the first dead. The identification of consciousness with the egotistic structure is number one death. Now to break that death, to kill that death, is the object of all religious systems, all teachings, all yogas. All aim at this one thing, the death of the dead. Death, once dead, there's no more dying then. What we have to do is kill the finite identification. That is, kill our belief that our empirical intellectual knowledge is wisdom, which it is not. And we have to give up that which we have most gathered. There's a funny thing about psychology, this. If I ask you to give me an idea, can you think of something, Peter?
Yeah.
What?
Nothing then comes
black. Mm-hmm. Right, fine. Now, when you told me that information, which I received, and I attended to it, I know what you said, and I guess it, and you had it, and before you gave it to me, you had it and I didn't. And when you gave me that, did you lose it?
No.
Now, this is the only realm in which you can give something away without losing it. The realm of spirit. If I ask you to give me an idea, cat, dog, horse, when you give them, you don't lose them. You've still got them. And you've increased the richness of reality by giving it away. The faster you give away what you've got, the nearer you approach to wisdom. So if you were to dig out every trick you've got, including all your cunning business tricks, and give them away to everybody you know, you'd be richer, not poorer. Can you believe it? The empirical ego says, I don't know about that. Now, you cannot enter the second birth, the birth of spirit, unless you recognize the truth of that. And remember that hierarchy is essential, is this. Hierarchy is nothing but the actual distribution of powers according to receptive capacity. You try to give your wisdom away loudly and clearly over the microphone.
Before you've got anything to give away, first of all, you have to collect.
You explain, collect, the fall in one simple little word. Collect. You've been reading. You've been lecturing to yourself. You've been projecting. But you cannot project anything except that which you already have. So you can never be in a position where you've got nothing to give.
Where?
To
yourself.
Why? It's already there. I know hundreds of things I haven't told you.
We're in the world, we're...
I don't need to affirm them. On one occasion they were talking to Buddha and asked him various questions, and he replied, well, of course the things I've told you are very, very small compared with the things I haven't had time to tell you.
A demonstration,
right.
Out,
will you stand up and become visible, please? Turn your back on me.
Now, I have to say that those people who drop them will make a certain sound. Now, I don't know exactly what the sound is going to be.
So, how do you know it's certain?
How do I know it's certain? I would have to.
Wait a moment. Are you talking about Newtonian gravity or Einsteinian?
Newtonian gravity.
Oh, yeah. You're already an anachronistic guy.
Providing Trevor
doesn't beat you to it by rushing out and catching them when you drop them. You see, there are other wills in there.
To learn, but first of all, the initiative has to be taken to get to the point where you're going to drop the key.
Are you at the point of initiative? Are you at the point of initiative yet? Or have you been talking and using it all up?
No, I'm not.
Have you? You've not touched the initiative at all? You've just been occupying yourself, haven't you?
I'm using the initiative and in a willed state, standing here, ready to drop these keys on the floor, which I will do.
Wait a minute. What did you demonstrate then?
I know that the sound of those keys would make a certain sound, but I didn't know exactly what the sound would be.
No, an uncertain sound.
Now I know what the sound was. And I know that also if I drop the keys again, it will be a different sound.
Yeah?
Yes.
I mean, derive that empirically off from Logos principle.
Yes, that sounds louder. Now I could then say that. My hand was higher. Fell a different way.
Yeah.
All sorts of combinations of something which becomes uninteresting.
Interesting?
Yes.
You mean you become interested?
This is interesting to me.
To you, yes. And why is it interesting to you?
Because it's experimenting.
But why do you experiment?
Because I enjoy it.
Why do you enjoy it?
Because it feels like living.
Feels like living. What do you mean by living?
Using the vehicle I have to be able to express something which I couldn't do once upon a time.
Are you avoiding saying extending my power?
I wouldn't say that.
Why wouldn't you say that?
Well, I have no need to say that.
Why not?
Well, for sake of extending my power seems as if it's something which is then mine.
Oh, you think it's not yours?
It's everybody's.
Everybody?
It's all ours.
Did everybody do the experiment?
No.
Did everybody get the benefit of it?
Maybe.
It's only a maybe.
Well,
could they get the benefit of it if they didn't identify with you doing it?
They would see things from a different point of view.
Would they get a different kind of power?
Yeah.
Think very carefully, Peter. Suppose you knew how to drop it in such a way that your power increased to the maximum. Would you then tell everybody else that exact technique to do it?
The exact technique, what to recreate?
To increase your power.
It just actually increase my...
You know what I'm going to do with you in a moment, don't you? I'm requiring you to go home, write a letter to all your business rivals and tell them exactly what your intentions are. And spread your knowledge.
I have to.
Have you?
At times, yes. I've found that sometimes honesty pays.
Have you?
Yes.
Pays means what? Increases your power.
Increases profit.
You don't like the word power, do you? You don't mind profit, but you dislike power as a word.
The word is
all right, yeah. No, it's okay. But when you say, I am dedicated to the acquisition of more and more egotistic power from now to my death. Somebody dropped the notebook. Power controlled by you. Power which gives you an advantage over other people. It gives you an advantage over your rivals.
I already feel I have an advantage over
you. Already? How did you get that? You got that by experiment?
I thought as if what I just said then went. It was a laugh which shown their power over mine.
Ah. There are other people in the world, isn't it amazing?
Yeah, well,
that's amazing. Well, have you finished your demonstration? And are we clear about what it was you demonstrated?
Initiation.
Well, we don't have to say that was initiation. Now let's distinguish between urge, UR, which is the same as the OR in original, UR means primitive drive, and GE is the earth, compaction of life. Urge, URGE, means an original urge which posits itself as an egoic structure and then tries to work through the resistance which it has posited. Yeah? Urge for action is action that you do because you have imposed the resistance on yourself by your mode of self-precipitation. But initiative doesn't do that. Initiative does not work against the resistance. Initiative merely posits that point of initiation, not the aftermotion, and the initiative posits the point and the rest of the universe reacts to the positive point. The world changes because of initiation. The initiation is not urgeful. But actually when you got up and dropped that bunch of keys to prove a point, you were dictated to by your memory of a whole series of theories acquired since you were a child, including Newtonian gravity theory. Yeah. So that really it was not an act of free initiative. You had an impulse to make a point. You stood up, made the point, but the point that you made was entirely reactive to your desire to a positive point.
My first one was to say Einstein, but because of the education that I had, I thought of using an apple, and that was it. I said, not what I felt, but what I learned.
Yeah, well, that's hurtful.
Yes,
you were caught by an identification, so that was enough initiative. Now, we're talking about this. The word will is W, that's you and you, wrapped together. The U means a movement tendency, and the W means a movement tendency contradicting itself so that it doesn't move. And then that double self-contradictionary tendency posits the point, which then does the work, L, against itself. W, two parts. Wrapped on each other, static. Point posited, not from edge, but from intelligent awareness of contradiction in oneself. Right? Is that clear? There is infinite power. Infinite sentient power. We usually represent that with SP. Here we're taking an S, put it into U, and a P, put it into U, because the S, the sentience, makes you aware of a possibility, and the P gives you the power to actualize that possibility. And when you put the two U's together, that's a W, then without urge you can posit. I have no urge to make a gesture in my left ear with my right thumb. Without that urge, I made the gesture. That is not an urgeful gesture. It's an initiative gesture. Now the W means the contradiction that the will observes in itself before an act. And it knows that if it does act, it will contradict itself. Yes, all of it.
Whereas if you do it from the action, you're not.
That's right. It's a particular thing.
Yeah, at the same time, you can say that that can also be misconstrued as spontaneity.
It can be misconstrued by egotism, yes, because that's the chief misconstruer. It is determined to misconstrue because it wishes to retain egotistic power. Now the I that follows the W means the point of initiation, initiated non-urgently, and the two L's after it signify the binding power of the contradiction. You know that if you initiate, something will happen, don't it? And if something happened, you as initiated are the cause of that happening. One of the methods of getting something done is get a good idea, but because of your knowledge of the contradiction in it, you get a friend to voice it for you. He's the one that gets shot, not you. It's the principle of the scapegoat. It's the principle of sending somebody to Northern Ireland to sort them out. You know, to get a bit cheeky, send them to Northern Ireland. So they sort that out. They come back chastened. Now W, I, double L. The W and the double L both belong together. There is a capacity of power to do something. There is a consciousness in the SP field that which is going to be done is going to produce a change which will contradict the very thing with which you start. And you're in perfect balance without any urge. And from that knowledge point, you nevertheless will to initiate. And you know that the thing you initiated is going to bind the person to whom the initiation comes. It's going to bind it to having started it, and bind it to suffering the effects of having started it. So in a non-urgeful state, if you get a good idea of how to create a revolution or something, you get a deputy to do it for you. You know there's going to be a reaction. And you don't want your head off today. Maybe you don't mind later. Today, you wish to keep it on. So you get a close friend to do the job for you. You've not been urgeful, but But when you make that suggestion of initiative to him, if he's at a lower level in the hierarchy, that is less and less centered, he will take that piece of initiative as a good idea and become urgent about it and do it. Yes. All politicians are at the mercy of an establishment that keeps inserting ideas. And the British people have voiced its will to enter the common market. Who said that? Who consulted the British people first? Nobody. And did the man that said it publicly think of the idea? Or was, over dinner, a little suggestion made? All the world's political decisions of any magnitude are not made in parliaments, rathhouses or whatever. They're made over dinner with intelligent people in very small circles. Now, once you've understood that will is never urgeful, then you can suspect that if you've got an urge, it isn't will. And curb it. Because it's urgeful. And when you get the urge curbed so you can stand still and either do it or not do it, then you can initiate it. But according to the situation, you'll either stick your own neck out and be crucified, shot, airplane accident or whatever, or you will get a friend to do it. The word friend there means one who frees you. A friend. And you see the tremendous importance of distinguishing between an act which is urgeful, which comes out of a blocked, inhibited condition of the psyche, and an act initiated by a free intelligence that doesn't have to do it and can delegate it. And which would you rather do? If you had all the rules of government in your hand, would you rather stand on a podium and shout them out to people? Or would you rather give them out here and there in many diverse directions and let them do it for you out of the generosity of their hearts? Here are all the rules laid down. Study the materials of the situation, the morale, high when happy, low when miserable. Study temporal tactics, internal strategies, initiative, HQ. When you know those six, you can handle your situation. If you can say the particulars applicable in a given situation, you can tell somebody else and let them decide to do it. And if they're on the periphery, and the nearer to the periphery, the more likely they are to do it, they will do it. And the nearer they are to center, to initiative in themselves, the more they will play that game of pass it along the line. Give the idea to somebody else.